Hello and welcome to Condensed History Gems with me, Greg Chapman.
And me, Jem Deducci.
And Jem, it's been a little while since we sat down and recorded this podcast, even though they come out every week. But the thing is, Jem, actually, and I'm going to get this out of the way up front, Jem, we are not recording this particular podcast live today because at this point in time, Jem, I am probably just about to get married when this is going
out. You stole my thunder, Don. Yes, this should be coming out on the 26th of June, and I would like to say congratulations to both you and Felicity on starting your journey together as husband and wife. There's no punchline or silliness. You know, genuinely, you guys are great people, and I wish you all the happiness in the world.
And Jem, I know that, you know, you would have been very happy to be at the wedding. Now, I just want to make it clear that Jem's wishing me this over there, not because I didn't invite him, because he found something better to do than attending my wedding as well. So with that in mind, Jem, this is kind of our wedding morning discussion. So no doubt you've gone away. You've found a topic that is suitable and representative and really fits with the idea of marriage and weddings and matrimony and love and all that sort of thing. So what are we talking about today?
Well, to be honest, it could be. The topic of discussion is sort of weird and wonderful moments from history. And indeed, there have been weird and wonderful moments of history in the worlds of marriages, political alliances. But there are so many things out there because, if you like, this is where I earn my living. You know, if you want the completely straight as an arrow type history books, that's not what I do. I love digging out bits where you sit there and go, didn't know that, or that sounds like it's made up, but no, it's real. Because for me, that's the exciting bit of history.
It is. It's all those little odd stories because, I mean, part of the word history, and I'm not doing the whole, you know, oh yes, it's his story. Oh, shouldn't we call it her story as well? But part of the word history,
I hate
is,
that, by the way. That's a misreading of the Greek. It's got nothing to do with the word his.
I hate that so much. But what is in there is the word story, you know, and that is always what I took history to be, is the telling of stories, the passing on of stories. And that's where obviously the tradition of history begins. It's oral history, it's passing on stories, it's letting people know what's important. And we all like a good story. And sometimes the good stories, the funny bits of history, they don't change the world. They're not something like a world war. They're not some major defining moment that changes history, but they're just this little moment in time, this little moment in history where something you wouldn't quite expect to happen does happen. One example, I'm going to kick us off with an example, if that's all right with you.
Off you go.
I'm going to kick us off with the example of Sudley Castle. Now, Sudley Castle, place I perform over the summer, one of my favourite places to perform, and it has all this rich history, and it's a Civil War castle, and, you know, Queen Elizabeth lived there for a while, Anne Boleyn lived there for a while, Richard III was there for a while, has all this steeped in history, and yet my favourite story involving Sudley Castle actually involves King George III, not there when it was a regal castle, but when it was a complete ruin. And George III goes and he's riding out in the countryside and he sees this ruined castle and he decides he wants to take a look. Then it's not particularly safe, but he decides he's going to take a look anyway. And part of the castle that's still standing is this large octagonal tower with a spiral staircase. And so King George decides he's going to have a look at what it's like at the top of the tower. And again, probably advised by his people that this is a rumbling old ruin and he probably shouldn't climb up it. But, you know, George III wasn't necessarily someone who took a lot of advice from anybody, except for the occasional tree, from what I hear. And so George III and his housekeeper, which is quite irrelevant, and his housekeeper actually go in and they have a look inside the octagonal tower and they climb the spiral staircase. And this housekeeper is a lady of ample proportions, shall we say. I only mention it because, once again, quite relevant to the story, because as they go up, they have a look around the octagonal tower, they're looking around, and as they start to come down the tower, George III slips on the staircase and comes crashing down this stone spiral staircase in a ruined castle, landing on top of the housekeeper with a thud. And this is one of those strange moments from history, because it's one of those where you look at it and you go, yeah, okay, the image of the king suddenly falling down the stairs and landing on his housekeeper, that's quite funny in a moment. But what then suddenly immediately takes that is, well, hold on, this is just this tiny little moment from history. It's a nothing. It wouldn't even appear as a footnote in most history, but this was a moment where the entire course of English history could have changed. Because if that housekeeper hadn't been there, having seen this spiral tower, I can tell you now, if you fell down that spiral staircase and you didn't have a nice, soft housekeeper to land on, you could quite easily be killed. And we could have had the entire British history change in an instant by the sudden change of a ruler, sudden death of a ruler slipping down a staircase. So that's where I'm going to start with my little bit of history.
And indeed, George III was the king who was in the second half of the Seven Years' War, which was really important for the British Empire, the American Revolution, and the whole Napoleonic War era. He was there at a real pivotal time in British history. So, I mean, he's also known as Mad King George. That happened later in his life. But if we'd had a different ruler, he might have put pressure on different people, and that could have led to a different outcome in all kinds of these really important global moments of history. So a great find there, Greg. I am going to come up with a bit of unusual history from a wedding. So now the reality is, as I said, you know, this is what I kind of do for a living in history terms. And my book, Forgotten History, is just full of these stories. And one of them is about weddings, and it's called The Most Expensive Dress Disaster in History. So I'm going to quickly read this out. It is a largely forgotten fact that Marie Antoinette, Queen of France, whose son was heir to the French throne, wasn't French. She was, of course, the daughter of an illustrious Austrian royal family. Her father was Francis I, the Holy Roman Emperor, and her mother was the formidable Maria Theresa. Between them, they founded the Habsburg-Lorraine dynasty, and her full name, Marie Antoinette's full name, was Maria Antonia Josepha Johanna. So she was basically brought up expecting to be married to a prince, to one of the royal families, and that's exactly what happened, because a woman of her status would have to find somebody of an equivalent political power. And that meant in April of 1770, she was to be married by proxy, which was not unusual at the time. So basically, husband and wife hadn't actually met each other at the wedding, to the Dauphin of France at the Augustinian Church in Vienna, where her brother was filling in for Louis, who was actually the Dauphin, the heir to the throne of France. So she's technically marrying her brother, but she's not marrying her brother. Her brother's just there as a stand-in, and that was not unusual at this time in Europe. And she was then taken to France to start her new life. On the outskirts of Paris, she was stopped and prepared for her first meeting with her new husband. And according to the fashion of the time, she was dressed in an elaborate wig and a sumptuous gown to ensure that she looked the part as she arrived in the city. Decadence and extravagant excess were the hallmarks of the French court in this time, and was considered even decadent by the comparison to the Austrian court or the British court. So they really pushed the boat out, the French, okay? And she would do what the occasion demanded. It's not recorded what she thought of all this, but, you know, she'd been brought up well to do her duty. And Marie Antoinette was due to marry Louis properly, as it were, this time face-to-face, a few days after her arrival. But, and this is where we get into the title of this thing, she would have only been in Paris for a short time before the big day, and the ostentatious wedding dress would have taken a long time to create. So in other words, they had to guess at Marie Antoinette's measurements. However, as flamboyant and opulent as this wedding dress was, the courtiers had guessed wrong, and the dress was too small. No matter what they did, she couldn't fit into it, and there was no other suitably amazing gown to take its place. So the only thing left was to cut her into the dress and fit it around her. The gaps were covered with strips of silk in an attempt to camouflage the catastrophe. Contemporary accounts do not comment on any imperfections, but then again, are you really going to talk about the Queen's wedding dress? But the gown was, we know, was dripping with silver thread and diamonds and pretty much every opulent adornment you might expect, and was also cut in various places and patched up as well. As grand as this must have looked whilst walking down the aisle, a close inspection would have revealed a wedding gown that was nothing more than an ill-fitting patchwork, making it perhaps the most expensive folly in fashion history. The dress, like many French royal excesses, was either destroyed or sold off during the Revolution. So there you go, a little bit of an obscure obscure bit of history. Of course, Marie Antoinette is more famous for how she ended rather than how she got married into the French family. But there are stories like this all over history. Isn't that right, Greg?
Well, that is right. And I know that, for example, Charles I, when he got married, he didn't bother to attend the wedding, wasn't in the right country at the time as well. And you have all these different things. But what I'd really like to thank you for there, Jem, is, you know, when we're recording this, it's about a week till my wedding. And obviously, we've had the traditional wedding dress worries. What if it doesn't fit? What if this? What is that? So I'm glad when I'm taking, you know, half an hour out of that to record a podcast with you, you've just taken the time to just relive that stress in my head for me.
Felicity
as well,
is a smart woman. I am pretty sure she's checked the size of the dress, right?
She has. I'm actually more worried about my waistcoat, actually, which I tried. Anyway, that's quite enough wedding talk.
Look, that's simple. Just stop eating the pork pies.
Yeah. Now, we're going to move on just slightly because obviously we want to keep moving through weird tales. And, you know, you brought up weddings, and I am, of course, am going to go to my classic fallback, you know, when I want to look for an odd story or something strange has occurred, or basically I just haven't done enough research. I'm always going to fall back to Harry Houdini. Of course I can. because
off you go then.
Because there are so many weird stories, and most of the weird stories, you know, involve stuff that, you know, sort of things that he's done, things he's created, but that there are one or two events from Houdini's life, which I just enjoy just for their slight oddness. And the fact that the oddness isn't necessarily related to Houdini directly, but other people's weirdness. One of the odd things, and I'm going to tell to say that this is a tale that some people think is apocryphal, but the people involved, both themselves, said that it was a true story. Did you know that Harry Houdini, when he was starting out, he was working in a variety of different shows, and one of the shows that he worked with, he was part of a traveling show called the Mohawk Indian Medicine Company. They had various performers and things going on there. And Houdini was working there. He was young performer. He was working there. And there was a young family that was working there, and they just had a child, a little infant child, 18 months old. And this little child, 18-month-old child, is toddling around, gets to the edge of a flight of stairs, and falls down a flight of stairs, bouncing most of the way down. Gets to the bottom of the steps, and, you know, I don't know why I've happened to choose another story involving people falling downstairs, but at the bottom of the stairs, this little 18-month-old basically, according to the stories, essentially looks around, gets up, and just toddles off again. That's it. And Houdini's supposed to have looked across and said, wow, that was quite a buster. And buster back then was a word meaning a fall or a trip or something like that. And from then on, that kid became known as Buster and grew up to be Buster Keaton, the famous silent movie star. And it's just like this tiny little crossing over for no apparent reason.
Is that true? Because we all know Houdini made stuff up. Do we know if that's true?
Well, Buster Keaton is the one that told this story first. Now, obviously, you know, people live their own legends and things, but no, this one did come from Buster Keaton himself. And we know that they were both working in... Keaton's family and Houdini were working in this same medicine show. So there is every likelihood that that one's true. But for another slightly different story that is definitely true, Houdini at one point, Jim, went over to Germany and he wanted to do a bridge jump. He wanted to do, you know, his classic thing of getting wrapped up in chains and jumping off a bridge. And the authorities didn't want him to do this. But it turns out that there's not actually any laws in Germany, or there weren't, specifically banning somebody from jumping off a bridge into the river wrapped in chains. For some reason, they'd never thought of writing a law about that. And he was told that he would get in trouble if he tried to jump off the bridge. And they looked into laws, and he decided that actually there was no way that they could arrest him or anything else. He wouldn't be allowed to publicise it in advance. He'd then be publicising an event. But as long as word of mouth kind of got out on its own that Houdini was planning to do this and the press photographers just happened to be there, he couldn't get in any trouble at all. And so, middle of Germany, Houdini arrives on this bridge. He gets himself wrapped up in chains. The police are all standing by, looking on. There's nothing they can do. He's not actually broken any laws. He gets up on the bridge, jumps off the bridge, that moment of silence. He's disappeared under the water. He manages to escape from the chains and everything. He comes up to the surface, raises his hands proudly. The police are looking on quite annoyed because once again, there's nothing he can do. Houdini swims over to the side of the river, climbs out onto the riverbank, and he is immediately arrested because there is actually a law in place that you are not allowed to walk on that particular piece of grass. Yes, yeah, so Houdini
did get
arrested. How long
was he arrested for?
I think it was only an overnight. He went in and they did all sorts of stuff in the courtroom. You know what people are like. Houdini actually got arrested for a few times and had to get himself out of trouble in various ways. He was actually, at one point, because one of his claims was he could escape from anything. And at one point, the story goes, he was arrested. He was put on trial because he'd made this claim he could escape from anything, and that was false advertising if he couldn't. And so the kind of went through this court case, and the story goes that the court case ended up with Houdini being, you know, someone suggested the judge had a safe in his office, and if they took Houdini in there and locked him in the safe and Houdini could get out of that, nothing prepared, then Houdini would be okay. If Houdini couldn't get out of that safe, well, then it's false advertising. And so the whole case hinged on him being put in this safe and locked in. And he did manage to escape. And later on, it came to light that the reason he managed to escape from that safe may have been the fact that the judge never actually locked the safe once he was put inside of it.
There we go. Yes, I mean, this is the thing that they say a magician should never tell his tricks, because as soon as you tell the people what the trick is, like, I slipped it into my pocket when you weren't looking, it's always disappointing. It's not because they're trying to hide any great miracle of technology. Invariably, the trick is disappointing, fundamentally. Would you agree with that?
I would. There's a wonderful quote by a guy called Jim Steinmeier, who creates a lot of tricks, and it says, what magicians do, as magicians, we are guarding an empty box. You have to make all this secrecy and all of this about the secret, and you've got to guard it, because if anyone actually finds out what you're hiding, they're just going to go, oh, well, that wasn't really worth it, was it?
Yeah.
Anyway,
I like that.
So what have you got for us next?
Okay, well, I figured I'd give you a completely different one, again, from the book, but a lot of people say this is their favourite. So it's called The Most Dangerous Substance Ever Discovered. Okay, new chemical compounds are regularly discovered, and some are done intentionally, some are created completely by accident. And in 1930, a very volatile compound was discovered in Germany by the scientists Ruff and Krug. It was so unstable that it was ignored until a few years later. We've then got the Nazis coming to power, and they liked trying to weaponize everything, and so therefore they started looking into it at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute. They called it Enstoff. Sounds sinister, doesn't it? But all that means in English is substance N. So it had some remarkable properties. It boiled at room temperature and produced a toxic gas. If the gas ignited, which it did very easily, it then burned at over 2,400 degrees Celsius. If it decomposed, it turned into hydrofluoric and hydrochloric acid, usually in steam form. It was corrosive. It was explosive on contact with water. So if you try and put the fire out by throwing water onto it, it detonates. If it bonded with carbon, it formed an explosive that would detonate on if touched. And it turned out to be a better oxidizing agent than oxygen. What does that mean in English? It sets fire to things that you don't normally think you can burn. For example, things like sand, glass, and asbestos. Now, to be clear, asbestos is a horrible substance, but it's renowned for being flame-proof. So if something can make asbestos burn, that's a pretty special subject. So, research and production of Enstoff was moved to the Falkenhagen Industrial Complex, which was basically a bunker where the Nazis did lots of horrible chemical experiments, okay? And their idea was to produce 50 tons a month and use it to basically melt or set fire to pretty much anything, like tanks or cities, obviously. The chemical name for this highly dangerous compound is chlorine trifluoride, okay? However, by the end of the war, they'd only produced about 30 tons. guns because it just kept setting fire to things, okay? One plan was to put it into a flamethrower, but because it would eat its way through the components of the flamethrower, it also managed to set fire to the flamethrower. So when the Falkenhagen industrial complex was captured, it was captured actually by the Soviet Union, and what happened to this 30 tons of the stuff, nobody knows, okay? Now, fast forwarding a few years, it was then picked up by a very different organization, because this oxidization, the way it was able to burn, even without the use of oxygen, makes it a really potentially useful rocket fuel. And so NASA looked into it as a potential fuel, okay? That was until the early 1950s, when a tank ruptured and spilled 900 kilograms of substance N over a concrete floor. And what it did was it then burnt the concrete was set on fire, okay? And it then burnt through 30 centimeters of solid concrete, and then, as a finale, burnt through 90 centimeters of gravel. Under any other circumstances, gravel doesn't burn, okay? It can be scorched and it can be melted, but it just doesn't burn unless you add substance N. If this wasn't bad enough, and NASA faced another problem with chlorine trifluoride, when it was mixed with any other propellant, i.e. fuel, it instantly ignited every single time. So, in other words, this is a direct quote from Dr. John Drury Clark, who's an expert in rocket fuels for NASA. He said, quote, "The operator is confronted with the problem of coping with a metal fluorine fire. For dealing with this situation, I've always recommended a good pair of running shoes." Unsurprisingly, NASA ended tests on this vicious compound. But today, there is actually a peaceful application for it. It is now used in teeny tiny amounts to clean superconductor chambers without having to dismantle them. Now, when I released this story on the internet, I had a few people going, "Oh my God, how irresponsible are you? ISIS could get their hands on this formula." And it's like, Yeah, they could. But if the Nazis with an entire industrial complex couldn't handle it, if NASA and all their rocket scientists couldn't mangle it, I say good luck to three terrorists in a basement somewhere. They will just kill themselves. Knock yourselves out, guys. This stuff is just, it's so unstable. It's basically the only thing you can contain it in is steel containers, steel drums, because what it does is it scorches the inside of the steel drum to create an inert compound. But if you scratch that steel, it'll basically burn its way through, and then you have that leakage which we mentioned, which burnt through, again, 30 centimeters of concrete and 90 centimeters of gravel.
I mean, there's just, that's more than just weird history. I cannot get my head around the concept of concrete burning. I can get my head around the concept of there being fire on top of the concrete, and I can get my head around the concept of concrete melting, but for concrete to actually burn, that's beyond, that's just confused me completely. I don't even know how that works. That is incredible. And like you say, it's one of those things of, oh yeah, no, don't give away this big secret. I mean, one thing you've not entirely mentioned there is you haven't entirely given us a recipe to make it anyway. But also just the idea that, yeah, someone's going to take this idea and go, oh yeah, oh, that's really good. That burns anything. I'll tell you what, I will mix that up in my basement and put it into a plastic bottle. I'm sure that'll be fine, you know?
Yeah.
Just a concept of that. But I've got another couple of sort of weird things from history, and these are ones where I didn't have a long rambling story to go with them, but we're moving towards the end. So a couple of little points from history that I quite liked while I was sort of researching this. The first one was the Leaning Tower of Pisa, which, of course, incredibly famous, fantastic. And what I didn't realize about that, I always knew that it had been built and then it sunk on the foundations. There was a problem with the foundation, so it sunk, so it was leaning. What I didn't realize was that the foundations actually started sinking when they'd started building the second floor on the Leaning of Tower of Pisa, not when it was finished.
Yeah. So they actually kept rebuilding, well, sort of took into account the lean, didn't they?
They took into account the lean, but it's the fact just looking at history and looking at someone building this tower, and it starts to lean, and so they just say, oh, we're only one floor up. We could stop, redo the foundations and start again. No, let's just keep going. It'll be fine. Let's just keep building it at an angle. And that was very much the route that they went along. So the idea, I like things like that in history where people have kind of looked at a problem, they've seen it happening, and they've just gone, oh, well, we may as well just carry on with that, really. And that leads us to these wonderful examples, because you think, modern day, if you look at that in the modern day, most companies, if they started to build that and it started to slip sideways, it would immediately be torn down. They'd either restart or reshore up the foundations. The fact that it didn't work and they just kept going makes that a unique building in history. So that's one of my two little throwaway little bits of history. The other one that I stumbled across, which I quite like, was obviously back beginning of the 19 or early part of the 1900s, we had the Great Depression, especially over in America. They had the Great Depression. Lots of people lost their jobs. Lots of people became homeless. You had these cities set up in the park of, you know, sort of homeless people and all of this going on. And a lot of those people couldn't afford clothes. And so they actually started to make their clothes out of things like potato sacks, large sacks. You'd get potatoes in, and people would make clothes out of these. And that seems, you know, sort of so tragic, so terrible. And you think there must have been a way to improve the situation. And lots of people had their own ways to try and improve the situation. Obviously, there were charities set up. There were people helping the poor. Obviously, a lot of work was put into trying to create new jobs and actually get America out of the Depression. But what I like is somebody who looks at an immediate problem and comes up with an immediate solution. And there were those people, and they're making their clothes out of the potato sacks. And people look at them and they think, do you know what? They should have something better to wear than just a shabby old brown potato sack. And the distributing companies actually started to produce their sacks in a wider range of colours and made them more colourful potato sacks, so that when people got hold of these sacks after they'd been used and turned them into clothing, they could actually make a fashionable range of potato sack clothing for themselves. They weren't just stuck with classic potato sack colours. The actual distributing company went, yeah, do you know what? We know what's happening to these at the end of the line. So let's, at the very, very start, design our potato sacks with the intention that down the line, they are used to make clothes for people that can't afford them. And I think that is a weird and wonderful moment in history when a company looks at the problem and sees that as the solution.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. That is a lovely, lovely story. So thank you very much. I was going to say something else, but you know what? I think that's the perfect place to stop. Quick plug time. But do you know what, Greg? I'm going to warn you right now. I'm going to do the wrap up of this particular show, not you. So is there anything you particularly want to plug?
I am going to plug, oh, well, I might as well, because I'm getting married to Felicity and, you know, this coming out on a wedding day. Let me just plug Curios Aquatica. That's Curios Aquatica.com. If you know anyone that teaches, if you work in a school yourself, if you've got kids that go to school, let every school you know about Curious Aquatica. That is the new show that me and Flick are performing. We travel around and we are trying to help clean up the oceans of the world as much as we can. That's my little plug for today. What have you got, Jim?
Well, I've already mentioned it, so I figured why not make it part of the plug. So yes, Forgotten History. If you liked the ones I've done, that's just two of over 180 different weird and wonderful stories that I've got in this one, starting in the Stone Age, taking all the way up to the 1980s, I think, is the last one. And it's just full of things like, huh, didn't know that, and wow, that sounds made up, but no, it turns out to be real. And that's if you like kind of the fun bit of history that we've been doing here. I mean, the last week's episode was about Spanish flu. That all got a bit heavy. So yeah, there's just sort of humans can be silly and weird, and that's also in history. But now I'm going to finish off. We normally say, you know, thank you very much to my lovely co-host, blah, blah, blah. I'll take it as read that Greg sort of thanked me, but I want to sort of say to him, on behalf of not only your co-host, Jem Deducciu, but also all our listeners as well, all the people who follow us on social media, I'm sure we all want to wish you and Felicity just a fabulous married life together. And, you know, next time you hear from Greg,
actually, behind the scenes, we will still be recording on the same day, but he's not allowed to talk about it anymore. Anyway, but yes, no, seriously, there's just, you know, there's no joke to this whatsoever. Just, you know, you two are really great people. You seem a great fit for each other as well. I'm hoping you're able to celebrate your golden anniversary come 2068, okay? Have a fabulous life together. And on that point, that's it for this week's Condensed History Gems.